Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 18th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this morning is Cheryl Ney. Session number is 98-10 and is titled A Sustainable Genetic Practice in the 21st Century. Let's listen in.
To my own particular case, she said, you know, I found myself using the concepts and the ideas that we developed in class, and I was using them in my paper, and this was astonishing to me. Yes. Okay, so what's going on in other classes?
But it's true, I've recently been in school, and so that learning process of learning how to think, that wasn't something I was taught originally, and so it's like, we can think, it's that we need to learn those tools.
That's right.
And that's what's made it so exciting and interesting. Any class I go to, there are ways to think about it that even if it's boring.
That's terrific.
Yeah. So I think that's what we need to offer in the younger grades too, is that ability to think, to realize that we don't have to have it entertaining to us.
Right. There's this whole movement, it's called critical thinking. And they're really pushing it. I think in the old days it was assumed that if you worked hard enough at a subject, you would learn, just kind of drop out that you were learning about thinking.
It did.
Those were the good old days.
There's some resistance to that. Folks who want to keep the three hours, pounded in by rote.
That's right. So I'd like to make this very informal today. I've been at it for 2 weeks, so and I'm having more videos. So they're on the track. I think we need to really maybe talk informally today. So I think to help that process, it might be nice to know maybe who you are and what your interest is in science or what your interest is in today's topic. Since we want to try to talk together in a shared conversation, it might be useful. You already know who I am and my interests. Should we go to you next?
Sure. I'm Cheryl's old man. My interest is genetics. Primarily arose from her interest in her studies, and I'm also a quasi-chemist. I've had a minor in chemistry. But as a law student, I've been able to tie legal studies with some of the genetic issues, and so I'm interested in how genetics might be abused in the future in terms of people seeking employment, potential discrimination in the area of insurance, you get to buy health insurance and or life insurance, some of the other issues. Well, just the general concerns as a citizen, about to Christian perspective, is it right to tinker with these things? What are our limits? So,
okay. I'm Chuck Merkin. I have a couple of people in my church who are research scientists who do research in DNA, and they like to keep up with it. We're going to do some seminars this next year too, and invite our people to be in conversation. But I've always had a deep interest in the relationship of science and our faith and its implications. So that's why I'm here.
I'm Gary Downing. I'm a banker from Portland, Oregon. I've always had an interest in science from a lay standpoint and in public policy.
And on this field, everyone has genes, so really everyone has a personal interest.
I'm Patricia Downing and his wife. And I've recently entered a new field, and I work with adoptions, and it's a new field for me, it's not a new field for the world, and as a therapist, an individual therapist.
Hi, I'm Ira Wang. I'm a Vancouver retired teacher. Are you related to Gray Downing?
Yes.
Yes, he has. Son Gary, why love Downing? Your mom and dad for many, many years. We all went to family Christ, I would guess, since the early 70s.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You celebrate our anniversaries together.
Who are you?
I knew Naira.
Yeah.
Well, yes, you knew that. When you said Gary, I thought, I know you have a son, Gary. I just ethical, moral thing is, I mean, the only reason is why I'm sitting here. You know, I'm probably more anti. I mean, I don't know much about it, but the little bit I know, I feel more anti than pro.
Okay, great. I'm Janet Simon. I'm a retired elementary school teacher. I like to learn new things, and it just sounds good.
And I'm Peter Giannis. I teach junior high school science. So I'm Martha Knick.
I'm a junior high school district coordinator for programs for gifted and talented students. And so one of the things that I was talking about, the kids in high school and the relevance of what they're learning there, and is it relevant, and should they have to do it, or should they be able to just go bing into college? And so that whole piece of it is really interesting to me, to meet up with obviously somebody with talent like yourself. And I'm just curious, you know, too, did you find as you were going through high school chemistry and biology that you wish that you could have gone faster and tested out of it, so you could have something better. And so, and this has just been very interesting for me this whole week.
Great. Well, I think we should spend some time talking about education, because that certainly is an important piece in thinking about the future. And so really, I wanted to try to spend this hour thinking about the future long range, not tomorrow when we all get home or what have you, but thinking about the future long range. And so I titled the session, something about getting to a sustainable genetic practice. And some of us have talked about this briefly, but one movement that's happening in the science community in order to think about the future is to move to this idea about sustainable science. There was a long discussion for many years among women and feminists in science, do we want to try to conceive of something called female science? And I think you can see kind of the dangers and the pitfalls that you might get if you had something called a male science and you had something called a female science. And so really, a lot of women in feminist and science really backed away from that question and began to think, well, let's just think together about what we might want science to be like in the future. And that's sort of how this idea of sustainable science arose. And my understanding of the definition, this is kind of something in process, but my understanding when we put the word sustainable on there is really to think about a science that is sane or just, or a science that's going to support life on the planet, you know, centuries, generations down the road. And so this is where this phrase, I think, sustainable science comes from. And so today I just really wanted to think about it in terms of genetics, because certainly this is probably the biggest issue that people are going to face in the next century, I would presume. So what would that mean to have something called a sustainable genetics? And I thought maybe we could explore that idea together. And just one other thing I want to say to get us started, and that is something that some of us also talked about in an earlier session. You know, we can spend a long time teasing out all the issues and, you know, feeling this kind of, gosh, you know, this is going to be a big one, and, you know, this is difficult, this is hard, what do we do? You know, we can spend a lot of time sort of looking at the situation and realizing it's a tough one. And we can spend a lot of time asking, well, how did we get to this point, right? But in thinking about the future, I think we got to think about how we can move forward. That if we don't think about that, then it'll roll right over us, right? And so we'd really like to spend some time thinking about what do we want from science in terms of genetics for our kids, for our grandkids, for the future of the planet. So I guess I'll just open it up to that. Questions or comments? We've got lots of different perspectives here, so we can have some teachers speak about what they might think training in genetics. You know, how early do you start? How societal do you base it? And what have you. And then we've got the faith perspective, so we can talk about it from that angle. Ordinary city. We all have genes, so we really kind of think about it. Anything come to mind?
What you mentioned earlier about cautiousness about this little business or whatever, I'm a little skeptical, if not cynical, about some of the stuff we're trying to do. But I think the
the goal of trying to find out the cause of some of these diseases and stuff is admirable. I think it's one we shouldn't try to stop. But some of the stuff, I don't know, they start tinkering with the future generations. That's what worries me. So I think it's justified. A lot of the stuff is justified, but there should be some kind of checks and balances put in place to keep control of what's going on.
It's almost like it needs to be, do people feel like they need to ask permission before they go ahead and do something? And if they're going to ask permission, who would they be asking that permission of? Who's
going to
take on that role?
So I think you're asking question about the checks and balances, right? Are we going to put that at the level of the scientists themselves? Are we going to ask for legal? Are we going to ask for sort of community-based participation?
Right. Or will it be the government saying, like, with the cloning, it's not going to happen, now you're out of here?
And what happens when the government does that and Dr. C moves to Mexico
and does it anyway?
Does his research down there in Mexico? What happens from a global perspective?
Yeah, and some of the stuff that is going to be, kind of holding the reins of the science and exactly what they do, and that's probably going to be left to a cult of expertise, whether it's high-level government scientists or bureaucrats or the courts or whoever. Some of the stuff we may have to take on a personal responsibility for as far as our own DNA. Okay, my doctor wants to do a test on me, and they're going to have genetic information. Who's going to have access to that information? I'm going to want to ask questions, about confidentiality. I'm going to be reluctant to give that kind of genetic information to insurers, to employers, to whoever might ask it. So I'm going to be cynical about protecting my own genetic information. I'm going to guard it very closely.
So then it gets in the computer, and it's supposed to be safe in there, but there's always someone who can crack these codes, and they seem to be able to do it with almost anything that they think is secure. Somebody knows how to.
So we may not as individuals be able to do a whole lot to shape and form national policy and a lot of these people. We can sure as hell say something about how our genetic information is dealt with. And so maybe just that awareness, if we would all walk away with that awareness today and tell two or three people, who knows, people may be sensitized to just how important it is.
Shirsty, the woman who was our genetic counselor in the forum, mentioned that she's in medical school, and what she's learned is that certain doctors have gotten savvy to this problem of getting the information out there and are very careful about how they chart things and to try to protect patients. But you can't always depend on your doctor understanding the ramifications and what have you.
Because you think in some sense it's still a matter of some people out there thinking so far away, don't want to realize how, in terms, it's just right around the corner. I mean, who would have guessed 10 years ago that they could have done Dolly like that? Oh my gosh, it's gonna take forever. And yet it seems like discoveries happen closer, 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 closer together.
I know in education they're doing a lot of, some of the high schools, they have students working on genetic engineering experiments. I wonder sometimes if parents know what their kids are doing in science class. And one problem that I've seen is that, maybe I've mentioned this, is that I know of cases where, the science teachers are trying to set this genetics in a societal context, and they're trying to be very attentive to societal issues, but yet we're not trained in both sort of counseling and also political science, so that one bad case has been where the students are actually doing paternity tests, and then they discover that the father they thought was their father is not their biological father.
Do they have an assignment to go home and take blood tests?
Oh. Johnny comes home from school one day, and guess what I found out today, Mom?
Whoa.
Oh, dear.
Guess what we did in school today?
You know, it's admirable on the part of the science teacher to make it relevant, but yet science teachers aren't, you know, trained to be counselors. Am I right about that? You probably have to do quite a lot of that anyway, but we're still sort of not trained when it hits home like that. So that's maybe another area where we can take individual responsibility. We can ask what's going on in our schools. And, you know, I wouldn't want to say we don't want to study it, but, you know, I would really want to make sure that we're doing something that's age appropriate and that's something that the teacher is well prepared to do.
Well, that's true in general, too, that there's a lot of things taught in school that should have a component of ethical or moral discrimination or whatever alongside of it, but it can't be done in public schools. So that's mm-hmm. just not possible.
Are you thinking of a particular example, or?
I can take one. Where I remember when I was a kid, we used to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now, I mean, that's a lot of schools, that's out. I mean, they don't even do that. So. You would think that patriotism and love for your God and country would be something that people would all share in common, but not all people do. Not all people think this is a fair country, and not all people think that there's one God, or, you know, so.
And not everybody wants to have their child have to do that.
Yeah.
And even if the option is given, your child can just stay seated. And yet, if you have a teacher who says, how come that child's not? And then you start this all.
Yeah.
Or the students.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's not really that different from, I remember when Gary and I, our daughters were in middle school and both of our daughters are adopted, and it was, you know, this whole project to research your family. And it's like,
you're stuck. Right?
They're stuck, we're stuck, they're from Korea, we don't have, and working in the adoptions field, I see a lot of people, they get this checklist and they get to check off what they do and don't want in a child. And I'm like, this is very close to genetic.
That's right, that's right.
And so will these people then reject? I mean, they want to know the history, and they can't always, but when that's possible, when a DNA test is developed, they can tell them, you know, this picture, then will there be more children rejected? I sort of like, it's an interesting dilemma there, too.
Yeah. So maybe more on an individual level, we could have more sensitivity towards the potential for. Pandora's box, please. You know, kind of open up.
How do you do that without being cynical?
So, I mean, sometimes I think it's appropriate to be, well, at least skeptical.
Yeah. Well, at the bottom of Pandora's box was hope.
Yeah. So, that was
the last gift, yeah.
One of the leading scientists early on, Alexander Rich, who got a Nobel Prize for DNA sequencing, used to say about rationalizing this move to just focus on genes, he used to say, to know your DNA is to know yourself. Now, I've come to understand that as, to know your DNA is to know yourself biologically. You know, but his claim early in the development of working on the Genome Project, there was this sort of religious overtones that this was the Holy Grail. To find the human DNA sequence was the Holy Grail, and that you would know yourself. And so we're going to move beyond just sort of practical issues, perhaps, and find ourselves shaped by our ideas about DNA.
You think it would become reasoning then for people to say, well, I should do this, or I could do this, or I'm going to do this because my DNA is like this, or I'm going in that direction because my DNA is sequenced this way.
That's right.
Sure hear a lot of that anyway. Well, you know, yeah. It's not my fault. Yeah. It was somebody else's. It was.
You know. We've already heard the Twinkie defense. Yeah. And I killed the guy because I needed my Twinkies.
Yeah.
And I can hear the next one.
Yeah. It will be.
I have a predisposition towards violent crime because of my genetic.
Mm-hmm. So it isn't my fault.
Right.
So is the soul encapsulated in DNA?
Mm-hmm. The religiosity.
You know, I think one for the scientists that came out of the physics community, and that where they hoped they could reduce life to just the molecules, you know, sometimes in my very cynical moments, I think that they really believe that if they just know the individual parts of a human, throw it all into a test, and they'll get human.
Yeah.
I don't think so, but I imagine there's some very reductionistic, biologically determined folks out there.
It's interesting, though, in AA, in alcohol recovery, you know, I'm in AA myself, and I've been for 12 years, it's always interesting that we all know we're genetically predisposed. Mm-hmm. And we know, can we look at all, we talk about our families of origin, mm-hmm. And yet, you know, part of the strong ethical premise of AA is that you are always accountable for, and mm-hmm. we hold each other accountable. Mm-hmm. And don't let anybody off the hook. A lot of times you'll see that, they'll want to blame it on the alcohol. And then other AA people will then say, no, you can't do that. You're accountable for your actions.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, we know it's in your genes. And that the ethics seem to develop, at least there, on a common understanding of and that's, you know, of the spiritual condition, because we realize that our sobriety is based on the depth of our spiritual strength,
mm-hmm.
And that then keeps the genetic predisposition in check.
Mm-hmm.
And so my hope would be, you know, that that common understanding as things change with genetic engineering, that there would be an accountability. But my concern is, though, that, you know, there's still not a common agreement all the time about which way it's going to go. But it seems like the human condition has an ability to realize when things are going. Bill W. and Dr. Bob learned early. You have to be accountable for your actions,
mm-hmm.
and so it seems to come out of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
If you have people of spiritual strength and perspective, and that probably doesn't matter what religion you are, then it really doesn't in AA either. That gives me some hope that all of a sudden we would become alarmed. You know, just like we became alarmed when people were put in mental hospitals and kept there and given too many medications, and they sedated them and most of their existence there, and all of a sudden we realized what a horrendous thing that was. So we let them out. And, I mean, they were set up for mental illness, and many of them with various types of mental disease. But we realized it was not a healthy environment. But it was still fraught with problems because now they're out in the streets. On the other hand, I think it's better this way. I don't think that was a healthy situation than putting them in state hospitals. Now we set up shelters for them, and, you know, public assistance deliver shelter and places for them to be cared for. And yet they're not. I don't think that was a healthy time for us. And then people realized it was unhealthy. When they went and visited state institutions and saw those conditions. And something happened when they were all herded together. You know, unfortunately, there's still too many pockets where they're not really reached and cared for. But, you know, I'm talking about until people like us, with a strong spiritual perception, need them to call the alarm and be responsible and not worry about other people who are not.
You said the other day that you were cynical.
Mm.
So now you're giving us two messages of hope. That's wonderful. So we really have maybe a couple models of. So AA can give us a model of how we can hold ourselves accountable for our genes. And then you're suggesting that. If we look at the past, there have been cases where communities can take action against injustice.
It's really funny at times when people will come in, they're newcomers in the program, and they just want to blame it all on their genetics, blame it all on the alcohol, and we call old timers. We'll sit there, okay, and we go to talk. And then we start to say, well, now, wait a minute. You know, then we try to help them very gently to understand that they can't continue. And then they have to deal with their shortcomings and defects of character and be responsible to them. That's the fourth and the fifth steps, you know, and moving down the line. Mm-hmm. And that they are accountable to take care of those and to keep that genetic defect in its cage. We call keeping the lion in the cage. And then there's some hope.
We all have personality traits that we know very well, you know, that we may want to keep down or may want to build up. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that as, I mean, I see that will, own that personal responsibility and will as being kind of a regulator.
Yeah.
What's the status with kids and how they are coming to know themselves? And, you know, do we have a good system for helping kids become adults who feel like they know themselves and can hold themselves accountable? What do you all who work with kids think about that idea? Are they learning it?
I'm afraid they're a little overpraised. I don't think the current, they're up in the grades by now, but you know, almost every time they turn around, thank you, dear. Hopefully that pendulum is going to swing to a little more rational.
I think it was all that, the self-esteem.
Yes.
The core idea is a good idea, but it became to such a point that, and kids realized it was false praise. It was for nothing that they were doing, and so then it becomes empty, and then we come to expect it. So then everything is building esteem, and it doesn't seem to be working because there's just as many kids doing alcohol and those kinds of things as before. You know. So even though it sounded good, it didn't hit home with the kids enough.
It's my feeling that the big problem in education is the parents who think that we must praise their children. And if we don't praise them, we're doing something wrong.
Uh-huh.
You can't believe how many notes I've gotten, how we're doing things wrong, because Johnny's not excelling.
You know what, I was told that I was putting simply too much stress on this third grader, because I wanted her to learn as a third grader how to spell her middle name, because I felt it was a life skill. Now that is not unreasonable, that I heard that from her.
Yeah. My last, you know, couple, 3 years of teaching, I was almost glad to be out for the same reason. When the child would sit there and wouldn't do anything most of the quarter, then the parent would come in and say, there's some special project they can do so they'll pass. Well, you know, here's the list of assignments they can turn in. Oh, but they couldn't possibly. You know, but the parents want the child to do very little and to get a lot for it, you might say. And that's getting to be so common. I mean, it's
several generations of this praise.
Yeah, I think that's what it all comes to.
But I do think I was starting to see. I just depended every year. Mm-hmm. A little.
Yeah. It's going back a little bit now.
Yeah. Well, I think what wasn't taught, along with the praise, also it was always coming from an outside source. The kids never learned when they could tell themselves, did I do a good job? I'll tell myself that. That's what I need, is for me to tell me, was the fact that how do you take constructive criticism? So even my daughter, when she would bring home something and I would say, you know, look over a paper and make remarks, she'd tell me that hurt her because I was telling her, and I thought, see, now this is where it got all bent out of shape in her mind. Somehow I was hurting her feelings by telling her that this was spelled wrong and this wasn't a complete sentence, and she didn't make sense here, you know, that was a hurtful thing to her personally and her psyche, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, but that was what was coming out of her mouth, that I shouldn't be able to tell her, no one should be able to tell her those things. That hurt her self-esteem. So,
I don't think genetics research is going to help us.
No,
I don't think
that's
going to help us.
That's parenting.
We
couldn't come
with
a free education. I'd like to take an education on this.
That's right. So,
in order to better deal with genetics research, we ourselves need to be educated, we need to know ourselves, we need to have kids who are learning to be, who are growing in that process of coming to know themselves. What else? What else might we need? What other models are there for maybe examples of how to deal with these kinds of things?
I think that Glasser's reality therapy is sometimes called control therapy, which people really object to. But the idea that we need to have that internal control, and we need to see that the external, the world is working externally on us, but we are still the ones who can choose. And when we say, you made me angry, or you, you know, that sort of thing, when we can start not seeing that you did that to me, I chose, whether it was from some other part of me or not, but I have the same choice to not become angry. I think that's sort of, you know, how we've been taught to think, that the self-esteem comes at us from outside, and then it's supposed to somehow reside there, and it kind of just falls off. So that's sort of the model that I've used. It's been helpful to me to work with.
I'm thinking that maybe genetic researchers need to learn to be accountable or to think about their accountability.
Well, the question becomes, the researchers that are doing these trials, as they do them, do you think that they have a vision in their head of where their work is all going to go, or is it, do they, this is my project, and for 5 years I've got a grant, and this is what I'm going to do, and then when that is completed, then I will go to the next step? Or do you think within that company or within that group of colleagues, that there is a vision for what I'm doing and how I'm making something happen?
I think there's a wide range, because there are more and more different kinds of people are going into the life sciences. For example, last year, I think the number of women who got PhDs in the life sciences was 52%. So that what that's saying is the field's opening up to people of different experience. And so more and more, you know, I know about several cases where molecular biologists have said to themselves, I can't be a part of this because I can see down the road, you know, where this might lead. I'd say that's minority. I think often in science people are working to keep their job, to get fame, to get fortune, or even just unthinking. You know, we don't have any training in ethics, history, philosophy. You know, we're trained to do our science, and we're so narrowly focused that I think a lot of people just don't think about the long range. That would be my take on it. Any other people?
Oh, I agree. I had several friends that were studying it for their PhD, and they're interested in the outer membrane of a mitochondrion cell, and they devote 3 or 4 years to it and write their paper. That's all they're interested in.
That's right, that's right. And should we put the responsibility on scientists for the use of the knowledge that they're developing? See, I think too often we want to put it on the scientists to think about the use. And I think it goes beyond scientists.
I'm a layman, but I see a scientist as the person that's pushing the envelope and is really supposed to be. Looking at things that no one else has looked at, you know, and seeing what they do. If I tweak this, is it going to go that direction or whatever? What people do with that, that's a different story.
I know. I hear often, you know, from people, you know, it's the scientist's fault. They should have known what the knowledge was going to be used for. You know, like,
what does history tell us about scientific developments? I mean, down through the ages have been, you know, hue and cry about new scientific procedures and abilities, and then pretty soon they become commonplace. And I mean, there certainly is a lot of good that comes out of scientific developments.
Well, how about transplants? When that first happened, was that a gas that you would take someone else's heart and place it in? I mean, an ethical question right there.
Shursty asked the question, do you think people sat around and wondered about the use of fire? Decide whether or not.
I'm reading a book today, and they invented the fire. They used to have just a common pit with a hole in the roof. Mm-hmm. And so when they could figure out how to build individual chimneys, then the lord of the manor ate by himself. He didn't eat with everybody. Mm-hmm. And that divided the class. Well, who ever thought of inventing a fireplace? have classes of people.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, I think our friends, the humanists, often want to read history, you know, in a much different way than those of us in science. So there we have science and technology influencing societal.
Sure.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good.
And that's what we were talking about on our porch this morning, though, that the idea of genetic engineering is going to do the same thing. It's going to make the lord of the manor and, you know, make a real division between people, people that can afford to tweak their DNA, and, you know, and then the bankers get involved. We're making home DNA loans. I'm kidding.
You can improve your child's educational opportunity.
That brings up a parallel question of ownership of this information. Is this, like with the Human Genome Project, is this information going to be kept for use by a particular elite group for a certain amount of time so that they get the edge and they get ahead and all the benefits from that? Or since we're all part of this human gene pool, should that information be made available to everybody, anybody who wants access to that information? Or we're going to turn it into a class issue, you know? Whoever sits next to the information benefits from it. Which technology has always been used that way. And the elite always get the fastest computers, the best information, the best data. And the way we're going to see that manifest, I think we might see that in our country, in Western democracy, is capitalism. Is we're going to have corporate caretakers, you know, or these people that are going to be watching over this information. They're going to hold this information because they have the capital, they have the money, and so we should ask questions when we see these companies delving into certain areas, you know, should they be doing that? And if I don't agree, am I going to spend my money? Am I going to support that kind of a company? Am I going to encourage other people around me to do that? So it's consumer. We have to be wise consumers. You know what I mean? They had a commercial out a few years back. Does anybody remember the Beatrice commercials?
The food company.
Yeah, where they came out and they had this ad campaign and they said, petrochemicals, agriculture, housing, material science, well, and all this. And then at the end they said, we're Beatrice. And everybody went, holy shit, they control everything. And it scared the hell out of everybody. And so they yanked the ads. They yanked the ads because it frightened people so much that one, you know, group would have so much power in every area of our lives.
And then what type of human beings will that power create? You know, do you genetically engineer out sin? I don't think that is that possible.
As I said, there's been some talk of religiosity.
Religiosity.
Yeah. Now I know where they can come from. First genetic pedigrees.
That's all. That'd be great. We just get in here.
They have church every night.
That's right. But yeah. Raising a whole
host.
I guess, you know, in hearing what you're saying, Mike, I feel oppressed by this idea that I have to take so much responsibility individually. You know, maybe what we need to be working towards is how do we be interdependent? That one nice model that we should take maybe would be the kind of conversation that we're having. You know, how often is it that people sit around from different perspectives and talk about these issues? That if we could pool our expertise, then it's not up to me to know about corporations, it's up to me to know about the science. It's up to you to know about the legal, it's up to you to think about the... So that maybe in a world where genes rule, we have to learn to be much more interdependent on one another. Yeah. So Holden would provide a good example of this kind of conversation.
Right.
Do you get that in a university setting? You personally? Sorry.
No.
No?
No. Universities have become a lot like corporations. That, you know, the mission now is to bring students in to keep the place running, you know. And so faculty spend a lot of their time keeping the business running instead of, you know, it's a lot like parenting, right? Do parents have time to be parents these days, right? Do university faculty have time to be just the thinkers in society? You know, the weighty thinkers, you know? It's not happening.
You know, I might add something.
Yeah.
Something we've talked about before is this trend towards the commercialization of knowledge.
I hate to do that thing.
The commercialization of knowledge where you always hear from local business, the schools aren't producing students with the skills that we need in today's, you know, competitive marketplace and blah, blah, blah. So as a result of that, and you've seen some several things. You've seen the curriculum has been dumbed down in many instances. Where they want shorter, you know, programs. They want to be able to get in and get out, get their degree. Students don't seem willing to take a lot of liberal arts classes. They want to take a lot of business-oriented classes, computer. You know, they want to see the tangible results, the fruits of their study right away. And the way they want to see that is in a job. They want to see that, you know, they want to see the job. So we've seen things like drive-through university, they've characterized it.
University of Phoenix. Corporate venture.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, and students say, I don't have time for this crap. You know, I want to know what this is doing for me. Is this going to help me get that promotion? You know, is this going to help me get a new job or whatever, and that's been beat into our heads for since the early 80s at least. Well, they keep telling us you have to be able to change and adapt and go from one career to another. And so the average person will have what, 6 or 7 careers in their lifetime. So
we're not even doing a good job to prepare people to do that, I don't think.
So that's just one thing that kind of from your question makes me think about.
I was reading grants in the state of Ohio this summer for improving science education, and I was reading a proposal for like primary ages, and the grant writing is a beast unto its own, but you know, the rationale was we need these third graders to learn this so that they can get jobs. I mean, it was stated as simply as that. What about just learning? Learning how to learn. You know?
Learning for the sake of learning, and learning so that you can critique complicated issues such as genetics in culture and society and religion, and put all that together in kind of a holistic approach. Think, you know, holistically. Are we producing students who can do that? Or are we producing students who are just ready to go back to school 2 years later to get retraining?
Because you don't have schools that have a common vision of what they are really there for. You have teachers and administrators, and everybody goes into their room and closes the door, and they teach out of what is up here about them. And so you might have a teacher who is teaching a kid to learn, and you will do it now. And I don't have to explain right now why it's important, but I know it will be, but I will teach you the love of learning and this. And you have somebody else that is why we're in school, is to get, so you get a good job. And already in 5th and 6th grade, they want to have career days. And it's really important that these kids start thinking about it and the relevance. You have to be able to, you know, I would say to a kid, if I can't tell you why this is important, I shouldn't be doing it, because then I haven't thought about why I'm doing it. Then I'm just doing it out of a role. But I'm not going to say that the reason is so you get a better job down the road. I have another reason for it, but I've got to have a good reason. But to have a common vision like that, I mean, not in my experience, it's a rare thing, I think, in a public school.
Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, where they were trying to teach the children to think about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. ISCS was called. Mm-hmm. It was hands-on. And the big complaint was, we weren't learning it. They wanted to know facts. How far is it to the moon?
Facts that they wouldn't remember.
Right. Yeah. And kept saying, we want you to learn how to approach an experiment and why you need controls and what is a variable.
Mm-hmm. How to solve problems.
Oh, yeah. But we dumped it after so many complaints and they weren't learning it.
And who's complaining? The kids or the parents?
The kids to the parents.
Mm-hmm. The parents. And then the parents come and say, it was good enough for me the way we did it before. Why can't we do
that? That's
right. Education is one field where the people in it really don't have much say.
They're not very valued either.
No. No, and the more experience you have, the harder it is to find a job.
That's right. That's good. Well, we're about out of time here. I would just say thank you to you, and really, I'm leaving less cynical, so I don't know how far I'm cynical. But to have people sit around talking about ideas, I think this is really a primary step. We've just got to be talking. So I really thank you for your interest, and I really feel enriched by your voices and your perspectives. So. Thanks.
Thank you. I would sign up for your lectures any day.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Now, do you do lectures, and then do you have labs too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have a lab program. I'll just brag a little bit. I won the teaching award this last year at Capital.
Well, I can see why.
And I had some faculty come up to me and say, oh, it's so good to see someone with high standards winning this award.
Now, isn't that something?
Because the students don't appreciate
it. They vote for entertainers.
Yeah, they don't
vote. Oh, the students vote?
Yeah, the students were part of this process.
And even in college, they vote for the entertainers.
If I can I just add something? Sure. Blah, 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 blah. A lot of the students that Cheryl gets are like pre-med students.
Mm-hmm.
And
they
have to suffer through courses like organic chemistry and stuff like that, and they just feel like, this is something I really don't want to do. I don't know. Is there some way I can get around it? Can I go to this school over here where they only require one semester of organic? And when I see this kind of as a third party, because I'm not in the academy and I'm not a medical student either, but I'm like, do I want this person to be my doctor? They're scared to death, and they're looking for the easy way out, and they're looking for just the minimum required course. And I'm like, this frightens me. So from now on, when I go to a doctor, sometimes I'll ask him a little chemistry.
And if you just get to the other one, then go to the
doctor. I'll say no.
That's really good.
It's not like you have to hear and understand what you're asking.
I know. That's the right answer.
Just see if they say it with a
four.
That's
a great one.
We can stop the date now.
Do you bring your other colleagues in, other research scientists together, and you discuss these same issues together?
Let's see. Well, in my department, we talk a lot about societal issues. I think what's wonderful about being in the Lutheran education system is that you can talk about science and ethics. Mm-hmm. I know the folks over at Ohio State in science, they don't talk about ethics. Mm-hmm. So we really, in our department, we're very committed to science and society issues and educating students about them.
That might mean our private institutions might have a greater role in the days ahead to keep this thing in check. Because it is scary, and it's. But if we have men and women of deep spiritual, ethical, moral concerns, I think it might be okay.
And I think that is really one of the most pivotal, foundational things we need to do. Mm-hmm. Is that we need to empower people to live and act with integrity. I have a resource for maybe folks in your congregation. The ELCA has a task force on science and technology.
Hmm.
They have a newsletter that comes out. I think they're working on a statement about genetics.
Mm-hmm.
So you just click on the webpage, I'm sure you can. All right, well, safe travels to you all. Thank you very much.